One of the most important books ever written is Plato's Republic. This book is a foundation stone of all of Western society. It's a foundation stone of Western philosophy. It's something that the Christian Church saw as reflecting before Christ many of the truths that we discovered in Christ. And the Christians adopted it, partly, it's not perfect, but adopted it into our anthropology because it had a very good articulation of what things looked like. If you haven't read The Republic, I recommend it, or at least the Cliff Notes version, just because of how important it is to our way of thinking. In it, Plato engages with the question of justice. And it's a dialogue, it's a Socratic dialogue, so there's a lot of back and forth, there are a lot of suggestions and ideas, and this doesn't work, or there's an argument about this. And eventually he gets to the point where his definition of justice is all things in right proportion, in right order, in a right hierarchy. And specifically, he talks about three things, and he uses them equally between justice in a city and justice in an individual. And through an analogy, he says these are basically the same thing. So in both a city and an individual, there is an executive function. In the individual, we would call that the intellect. In a city, that would be the executives, those who run the city. There's also what he would call the passions. For an individual, that's going to be our strong and more elevated emotions, sort of the emotions that we would more regard as human emotions. In a city, he says, the passions are the military. The passions give strength to whoever they are serving. And then there are the appetites. In a human person, that's going to be something like hunger or the need for shelter. In a city, Plato, and this is why it's not perfect, he's not quite very generous to the working man, but for Plato's city, it's the working classes, those who produce food or those who produce goods. And he says, justice happens when these three things interact in the appropriate manner. So, for example, if the appetites rule, and think more of the individual here, if the appetites rule, then we, as individuals, look like animals, because the appetites are animalistic. So we are only acting out of hunger or a need for shelter or whatever other base corporal desire we have, we're going to look like an animal. If the passions rule, they aren't anchored to anything. So they represent power. In us, our emotions are powerful. In a city, the military is powerful. But throughout history, you can see in a lot of different coups and different overthrowing of governments, power that's not anchored to something is just power looking for more power. It just becomes an endless cycle of power. And that happens in our lives as well. If we drive ourselves only with our emotions, then those emotions are constantly looking for more emotions. If I think that life is living in a way where I feel excited all the time, then I'm going to look for the next thing to make me more excited. And my life won't make sense unless I am constantly excited. Or, Plato says, the other thing that can happen is the passions can serve the appetites. So imagine you're living your life just for food or just for base animalistic pleasure, and then you put your passions behind that, you're going to be an animal that's particularly powerful. Instead, he identifies justice happens when the executive function, in the individual, the intellect, when the executive function rules the others, when the executive function provides direction. The passions and the appetites are necessary. He's not saying that we should suppress those or they shouldn't exist. A city needs a military and it needs a working class. But he says the executive function has to rule. It has to direct the passions. It has to direct and control and keep in check the appetites. And when that happens, the individual becomes just. The individual is rightly ordered and acts appropriately. Similarly, in a city, when the executive functions are in control, the city finds justice. It is well ordered. If you want to see this in action, why philosophy is in fact practical, Think to yourself, of all of the news you've seen, let's just say in the last 10 years, or in the last 10 months, or even in the last 10 days, how much of it looks like it's being driven by the passions? How much of it looks like it's being driven by the appetites? And does it look like things are just because of it? Fill in your own blanks. But in the individual, and Christianity has maintained this, the just, well-ordered individual operates from their reason, from their intellect. And that intellect directs the passions and the appetites. We see this in Christianity in this first letter from St. John, our second reading. He says, "Children, let us love not in word or speech, but in deed and truth." We get in trouble as Christians when we think that God is love, or love God and love neighbor, means that you are supposed to have an emotion about God or an emotion about your neighbor. When we think that love means the emotion of affection, that would cause God to hold us accountable for something that is not in our control. The passions are very much like a river, and they just flow where they're going to flow. And so if you're held accountable for who you have affection for, then you're held accountable for something that you don't fully control. And that's not fair. It's not just. Instead, Christianity has always understood love to mean a choice, an act of the reason and the will. And so even if I find somebody deeply annoying, none of you, of course, but even if I find somebody deeply annoying, I can't necessarily change that, but I can still love them because love is a rational choice. It's something that I do from my will. I choose to act in the way that is best for the person in front of me. I choose to treat them like a beloved child of God. That's what it looks like to love neighbor. And with God, similarly, I might have struggles with the Lord. I might be up or I might be down with Him at any given day. But I choose to do what I need to maintain my relationship with the Lord. I choose to act out of my intellect and to say, whether I feel like it or not, I'm going to pray today, for example. So when St. John says, "Let us love not in word or speech, but in deed and truth," he's identifying that love exists in deed and in truth. Love is evaluated by our choices, by our actions, not necessarily by our feelings. The intellect is directing the passions. The intellect is where love begins and where we're held accountable. Now, the second phrase in there, the NAB translates in a rough way. And this Bible that I'm about to pull out actually says, verse 19, it says, this verse is hard to translate, so there are a couple ways it can go. But I find the Revised Standard Version has an easier way to understand this verse. The next thing St. John says is, "By this we shall know that we are of the truth, and reassure our hearts before Him whenever our hearts condemn us. For God is greater than our hearts, and He knows everything." He's identifying here that from time to time, our hearts will condemn us, that we need to reassure ourselves even as our hearts condemn us, and that we know that we are of the truth because God is greater than our hearts. Which is another way of saying, if we want to evaluate our passions, we use our reason and our intellect. If we know what the church teaches, what God has revealed in the scriptures, and then what has been communicated to us through the tradition, we know what God expects of us, what He asks of us. And we can evaluate our hearts against that. So from time to time in the confessional, I'll have people confess, "Father, I'm not close to the Lord. I don't feel like I'm doing enough for the Lord." And then I have follow-up questions. I say, "Well, are you going to Mass on Sunday? Are you going to confession regularly?" "Obviously you are. We're in the confessional. Are you praying at home? Are you trying to find a way to love your neighbor?" If the answer to those questions is yes, then it doesn't necessarily matter what your heart is telling you, because the objective reality is you are doing what is necessary to stay close to the Lord. Whether you feel like you're close to the Lord or not, the facts of your life are that you are close to the Lord. So if your heart is condemning you, it can from time to time condemn you unjustly. And God is greater than your heart, and you need to see that maybe you are doing fine. On the other hand, I'll often talk to people about going to confession, and they're like, I'm fine, I'm good with the Lord. And then it's like, well, are you going to Mass on Sunday? Well, you know, when I feel like it. Are you praying? You know, sometimes before bed. Well, then your heart is condemning you in a different way because it's telling you you're good to go when the facts of your life are saying otherwise. Again, we have to evaluate these things first with the reason, which is going to direct our passions and our appetites. Now, in the greatest bait and switch of all time, this is the annual Catholic Appeal homily. When I talk about tithing, and I do talk about tithing twice a year, once for the parish, once for the archdiocese, I emphasize a few things. Today, I want to emphasize the rational aspect of tithing. I've been talking about tithing based on a percentage. Knowing what your income is, we've all just filed our taxes, we all know what our income is. Knowing what your income is, and picking a percentage. And the reason I emphasize that is because it makes tithing a rational practice. It's easy to say, oh man, Father Moore's homily this week was a stinker, so this is a $1 week in the church, you know? I've never had somebody say, Father, your homily was so good, this is a $100 week in the church. I've never heard that one. But if you pick a percentage, if you say, this is my gift to God and the church based on the objective circumstances of my life, then tithing becomes a rational practice. It becomes something that we choose in love of God and love of neighbor. And it allows us to continue with that choice as things go up and down. So, for example, if you get laid off and the circumstances of your life change, there's going to be a lot of panic in that. But the system works because if your income is zero, then 10% of your income also zero. It takes care of itself. But more important to me, because I'm constantly worried about inflation, if your income goes up, if you get a raise, well, the tithe goes up as well because the percentage is still a percentage. It makes it a rational practice that just continues well as things go up and down in your life. This year for the annual Catholic Appeal, our goal is $110,000. And last time we did Mass counts, we had about 1,100 people at Mass each weekend. So the math works out great. It means we need about $100 from every man, woman, and child in this church. So a family of five, it would be $500. A family of two, it would be $200. Now, look around the church, think, do I really think that this two-year-old is going to be giving $100 to the church? So every dollar above $100 that you give to the annual Catholic Appeal, think of it as sponsoring the elementary school student or the infant or the college student in your midst, or maybe the person who is on a very limited Social Security income. Anything above $100 for each person in your household, it goes toward helping make up for those folks who can't necessarily do $100 per person. But that's a way to think about it, and it's a way to rationally evaluate our gift to the Archdiocese. I say gift. It's a tax. We have to pay this either way. If we don't make $110,000, the remainder comes out of our parish budget. And in fact, last year we didn't make goal, and a very generous parishioner had to write us a $7,000 check so that we wouldn't take it out of the parish budget. But when we evaluate how we're going to interact with this tax, it's helpful to ask, okay, where am I relative to what the needs of the parish are and the needs of the archdiocese? And also, where does this fit in to the percentage that I've chosen of my income? Personally, I pick my percentage, and then I give a third of that to the church, to the parish, a third of that to the archdiocese, and a third of that to other worthy causes. Functionally, that is two-thirds to the parish, because again, anything above the goal comes back to the parish, anything below the goal comes out of the parish, so my third to the archdiocese is really just the third in the parish budget that helps pay for the archdiocese. The whole thing. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is, hopefully you've picked a percentage. Hopefully this is money you've already committed to give away when we do our exercise in November, and that this is not a surprise to you. But if it is, use that $100 metric. Think about sponsoring other people in the church. Maybe you can give $125 per member of your household. Maybe you can give $150 per member of your household. It's very helpful. I will say two other things. First, I learned recently about something called bunching, which is a tax term. Because the standard deduction has gone up and many of us don't reach it anymore, people have started only giving to charity in odd number or even number years, which means that all of their charitable giving is concentrated and they hit standard deduction, they can itemize, they save a lot on taxes. That's fine. We are all about you using all the tax loopholes you want. That's fine. But from the church's perspective, because we always talk about this in April, if it's not your year, if you're going to give on January 1, 2025, because you're in odd-numbered years, that's what the pledge is for. You can tell us that in January you're going to make that donation, and then it's counted toward the parish, we know we're going to make gold, we're good to go. So just let us know you're going to do that if it happens. Second, I give online. I like to give online. I'm a millennial. I don't even have cash on me most of the time. Totally fine. Big fan of that. But if you do it, don't do it like I do and wait until June, because the diocese is going to start emailing me next month about, like, every week they tell me what our pledges are. And so if you want to save my anxiety in the midst of partners in the gospel, just, like, do it earlier so that I don't worry about this anymore. That'd be helpful. And a final practical note on that, I can tell you I've been very impressed with the Archdiocese this last year and a half. Working closely with the new officers, the new COO, the new Vicar General, they've been incredible in supporting parishes with partners in the gospel. They're very responsive. I've brought up some issues, and I got a response within a week. It was a very good response. When we talked about some budgeting issues with our school because of the way we budget our school different than the rest of the archdiocese, I got satisfaction very quickly in a way that benefited our parish. So I've been very, very happy with them. I give out of obligation because I'm an archdiocesan priest, but this year I also give out of joy. Like, I'm really happy with what they're doing downtown Seattle, and I really want to support that this year. A final note. The thing I always emphasize about tithing that I'm going to emphasize again is that it's a spiritual practice before it's anything else. It is something that helps us grow closer to God. And that's what you see in this gospel. What tithing does is it reminds us of how much we rely on the Lord. We are tempted with money to say, I am perfectly self-sufficient, I can take care of myself. If I put enough in savings, if I put enough in a CD, if I invest in the right way, then I am fine. We don't have any dependency at all on the Lord. Tithing is a reminder that we do still depend on Him. If we give a percentage away, we say, Lord, this money is yours. I recognize that it's yours. I'm going to give you my first 5% or 10%. And then we remember, I'm not responsible for taking care of myself. The Lord takes care of me. This is the vine and the branches. If we separate ourselves from the Lord by being perfectly independent of the vine, we dry up. We can't produce fruit. The water that is communicated through the vine doesn't come to us. But if we depend on the Lord, and tithing is one of the ways, concrete ways, we express that dependency. If we depend on the Lord, if we're constantly pulling from Him for our peace and our happiness and our safety and our life and our livelihood, well, then we're pulling the nutrients and the water from the vine. We're depending on Him. We're saying, Lord, I know that if I'm separated from You, I am nothing. This is a spiritual practice. I thank You for taking all of your spiritual practices seriously. For making an intellectual decision to say, I'm going to pray for a certain amount each day, whether I want to or not. I'm going to come to Mass on Sunday, even if I'm tired of Father Moore's stupid face. I am going to tithe, even if I don't feel like it. Those are intellectual decisions, choices in love for the church, for the Lord, and I thank You for them.